We're going to open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing on Friday, March 22nd, 2013. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2890. Regina.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2890 has no revenue impact, and it may have a fiscal impact. It repeals the section of the Oregon Code relating to local governments that impose conditions on approved permits that effectively establish sales price for residential development or limit purchase to class or group of purchasers.
Thank you, Regina. We have a list of people who are wanting to speak.
I'm voting for you.
I'm sorry, didn't see you. Come on up. Next, after this, we'll have Mayor Kitty Piercy and Nicole Johnson. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, committee, my name is, for the record, my name is Representative Jeff Reardon, District 48. And thank you so much for seeing me on this Friday afternoon. I appreciate that, taking the time to consider this bill. The bill before for you today would remove a ban on inclusionary zoning. The ban prohibits elected officials from making important decisions about what housing gets built in the communities they were elected to represent. Let's read that again. The ban prohibits elected officials from making important decisions about what housing gets built in the communities they were elected to represent. It's a tool local authorities may use to require construction of some affordable units. No one, and it's important to understand, no one is required by this bill to use the tool. It just allows them to. Please look at the two documents before you. We've got a handout in your before you. Together, they illustrate where to find affordable housing in the Portland area. The blue line is 82nd Avenue, and the yellow line is I-205. You'll notice that affordable housing is most available east of 82nd, but not to the west. That's important for two reasons. First, people should be able to live and work in the same area, but our teachers, firefighters, and police that serve the west part of the city are often unable to afford to live there. Second, having the majority of affordable housing in one part of our town creates other problems, problems that have affected my part of town for the last 10 to 15 years. A lack of affordable housing is the first of many falling dominoes that affect the livability of East Portland and other areas. My area is one of only a few in the city where an average family just starting out can afford to buy a home. The concentration of low and middle income residents has kept East Portland from earning its fair share of attention from local governments. Roads there are in disrepair, and students lack sidewalks near their schools. The lack of nice homes and influential residents has left us often ignored by the rest of the city. The crisis, in turn, places unnecessary strains on schools in the areas because of the influx of residents searching for affordable homes. For example, David Douglas serves over 10,000 students. We're doing well, despite overcrowding and shorter school years, but we carry a burden most districts don't have to contend with in terms of poverty and the diversity of our classes. Areas with mostly low and middle income residents and areas with mostly high income residents suffer from economic segregation. But when areas decide to apply inclusionary zoning, they include a variety of housing, they promote economic diversity within neighborhoods. This diversity combats segregation and leads to integration, which provides a place for residents to live and work. Students achieve better outcomes, crime rates drop, and health of residents is improved. Let me give you an example. Oh, never mind, I'll skip that. It's in your reading. I represent East Portland, but this issue affects cities around the state. It is Oregon's mix of urban metropolitans and rural farming communities that make our state unique and strong. There's not a one-size-fits-all approach to affordable housing, so why does Oregon have a law on the books, a law that no other state besides Texas has adopted, which limits our local government's ability to provide safe, clean, and affordable housing to the residents? When a ban on inclusionary zoning was originally passed in 1999, proponents argued that affordable housing was a societal problem, deserving of a societal solution, and that a single industry shouldn't bear the cost. But inclusionary zoning, requiring a diverse housing mix, is a societal solution because the cost is shouldered by the community, where each resident may chip in a little extra for the people who keep us safe, who educate our children, and who maintain our city. And they reap the added benefits of economic integration. In fact, the lack of inclusionary zoning policies has just made our societal problems worse. I strongly believe repealing the ban is much fairer than the current model, which burdens the residents and schools of one area by lowering property values and increasing crime and class sizes. If a perfect solution does not exist, then I ask for an aye vote on House Bill 2890, which allows the community to pull together to support each other. I ask you to support a solution that returns to local governments one more tool in their tool belt to meet affordable housing goals. And I ask that you stand up for the middle-class family so they can enjoy the life of home ownership that we all once took for granted.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Yes, Representative Whitson.
I just have one. Is that David Douglas High School? When you say 10,000 students?
Yes. David Douglas School District. I'm sorry if I misspoke. So the high school is around 3,000, 3,200, which is the largest on the state.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you for having me today.
So we have Mayor Kitty Piercy, Nicole Johnson, and Dorothy Rash, I think, is that?
Yep.
And just, okay, we'll wait for just a minute for you, dear. Okay, Mayor.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Tomei and Vice Chair Olson and members of the committee. My name is Kitty Piercy, and I'm pleased to be here to speak as Mayor of Eugene in support of House Bill 2890. Eugene, like most cities in Oregon, is facing significant challenge to provide an adequate supply of housing that is affordable to all of our residents. As you are aware, the state requires that every city provide an adequate supply of housing for all income levels. We are currently in the process of developing strategies for how to accommodate our housing needs for 34,000 residents expected over the next 20 years. We expect that over half of those households will not be able to afford market rate housing, over 30% of their income needed. To tackle this challenge, the City of Eugene convened a broad coalition of community stakeholders to create a vision for our growth over the next 20 years. Home builders worked side by side with neighborhood residents, environmentalists, and business owners to create a plan for supporting economic prosperity in our region. We call that Envision Eugene. We recognize that success depends on a cooperative relationship that results in economically viable options for developers. Our region's ability to meet the entire spectrum of housing needs within our community is a critical component of this plan. Right now, we are falling woefully short on this measure. Every day, I see and hear from hardworking families, veterans, and seniors that cannot afford decent and safe housing. More than half of Eugene's renters and a quarter of Eugene's homeowners pay more than they can afford for housing. Their housing instability reverberates throughout our community in the forms of lower student achievement, greater traffic congestion, increased foreclosures and convictions, and lost economic productivity. Unlike many states, Oregon has a strong history of requiring local governments to ensure an adequate supply of housing for all income levels. Yet, we are only one of two states in the nation, Texas is the other, that intentionally restricts its cities from having the choice to decide how best to achieve that goal. Given these circumstances, we believe this issue is a policy matter that should be made at the local level. House Bill 2890 provides the opportunity. The City of Eugene has been working diligently with the development community to revitalize our downtown and to incentivize housing projects of all types. A student housing project was recently opened downtown by Lane Community College. Two additional market rate projects are under construction. We welcome the addition of new residents downtown to make our city center thrive. We would like to add the opportunity to put additional tools in our redevelopment toolbox to help us out of this recessionary period, to create a housing mix that is accessible to all of our community members. In order to realize our vision for growth, we need to have every tool at our disposal. Inclusive housing is a critical tool that should be available to my community and to every other community in Oregon. Many other places have worked successfully with their local home builders and developers to create appropriate and effective inclusive housing policies to create greater options and choices for family. In my city, we'd like to have that same opportunity. The current prohibition unnecessarily limits local options and control, and so I ask you on behalf of the City of Eugene to vote in support of House Bill 2890 to remove this local restriction. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Mayor.
Hi, my name is Nicole Johnson. I'm 22 years old, and I'm a recent graduate from Portland State University with a bachelor degree in social work. And I'm now the new youth organizer at Opal Environmental Justice Oregon. I was born in Compton, California. My mom and I lived in an apartment in a poor and dangerous neighborhood, and we moved to Oregon in 1997 when I was 7 years old so that we could escape the poverty and violence that was going on. My mom wanted to make sure we escaped that and give me opportunities to succeed. We first lived in a duplex off of MLK in Killingsworth, and I remember talking to my mom about how there weren't as many black folks in the area. But looking back, I know that this was one of the few places in Portland where I could feel at home. My mom was really picky about housing, and she wanted to find a safe and healthy place with decent schools to live in. This was tougher than you might think. We dealt with a lot of mold issues, but the landlords never did anything about it, other than to keep raising our rent year after year. But because we didn't have a lot of money, we ended up moving around a lot. I remember my mom being frustrated because rents were rising and we couldn't afford to live in some of the new apartments that were coming up in the community. We ended up moving out to Southeast Portland, is what is now known as the Foster Powell neighborhood. I was happy there. I went to Franklin High School, and I excelled in both the community and at school.
Nicole,
but over time, yes.
Could I ask you to move the microphone a little bit away from you?
Sure. Is it too loud for you?
Okay.
Thank you.
Is that better?
When it's too close, it's distracting.
Okay.
Yeah, you can't hear as clearly, so
okay.
You're fine.
Is that better now?
Yes.
Okay, good. So after moving to Southeast Portland, we started to have problems. There was mold in the bathroom, the ceiling was leaking, and the landlord wasn't taking care of the property. And of course, he raised our rent every year. And eventually, we couldn't afford to stay there, so we had to move again. I've been a hard worker all my life, short time. And it was normal for me to have two jobs while in college. My mom preached to me the value of an honest day's work and that nothing in life is free. But now that I'm out of college and working full-time, I'm starting to realize that that may not be enough. My mom and I couldn't afford to live in any of the new fancy condos that were popping up in all over Southeast Portland. So we started to look further and further out until we found a nice apartment out on 174th and Powell, way out in the numbers. We've been out there for almost a year, and the apartment is nice, but it lacks opportunities, amenities, and culture. When we lived back on MLK in Killingsworth, my mom was able to ride the bus downtown to work, and we had plenty of fun shops and restaurants that we liked. When I go back up there now, I'm really amazed about how different it is. I only recognized one store from my childhood, and I had a really hard time seeing myself live there today. So clearly, the urban redevelopment was not meant for me. Even when I go back to my old neighborhood in Foster Powell, the Food for Less, the only store that we could get everything cheaply, is now closed. And it's really hard. Way out on 174th and Powell, I'm really far from everything, especially my friends. The closest grocery store is way out in Gresham, and we go there because it's the only closest affordable grocery store in our neighborhood. My only other option is the Burger King around the corner, and it would be nice to live in a neighborhood with healthy food options nearby. Being transit-dependent means I spend a lot of time on the bus. It takes me an hour with at least one transfer to get to work near my old neighborhood at 50th and Division, and it takes even longer to get downtown. It takes about an hour with two transfers to get to my community center, which is on 106th and Stark. This would only take 15 minutes by car, but I can't afford that full cost. All that time and money I'm spending on transportation could be used for other things that would benefit myself, my mother, and my community. It would be nice to live in a neighborhood with more transportation options, including north-south connections and more frequent and reliable service. It would be nice to live in a community where the neighbors felt safe with one another, where the air was clean, where there were good schools and parks and shops, and where I could feel like I'm a part of something. I don't feel like I'm entitled to anything, but I should have my fair shake. When I see all these big condos going up all over town and learn that my city can't take advantage of the best tools out there to help people like me, it's clear that something's wrong. My mom and I deserve the opportunity to live in a safe and healthy community. Please help us make this a reality by passing House Bill 2890 out of your committee so we can finally have an honest dialogue about housing opportunities. Thank you.
Thank you, Nicole. Any quick questions?
Can I just make a comment? Chair, really thank you both for your presentations. Those are my old neighborhoods, too, that I
really?
Grew up in. Yeah. So, and I think you did a great job as a, you make the social workers proud. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mayor. Mm-hmm. I should have probably asked this question of Representative Reardon, but in his closing argument statement, he said, if a perfect solution does not exist, then I ask for an aye vote. I am curious your thoughts on this. If we repeal the statute, would you see this giving authority to local government then to set a price target for builders and construction workers?
Vice Chair Olson, what I would see is that it would just have a tool, give us a tool in our toolbox among all the other tools that we have, and that we would work with our home builders and development folks and all the other people who collaborate in our community to come up with the best way of using that tool that we could to serve everyone and to make it economically possible for people to find housing that they can afford.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. Anyone else? Thank you very much for coming to testify today. So, Dorothy, can you get some help getting up here, dear?
Oh, yes.
And then after this, we'll have Aaron Doyle and John, is it Doyle? Yeah, Doyle and John Ostar. Okay. Just identify yourself, please.
Yes, ma'am.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dorothy Rash, and I'm here today to speak with you because I believe, can you hear me?
Yes.
You're doing fine. Because I believe we should all have the opportunity to have safe, stable, and an affordable place to live. Hardworking Oregonians like myself want to live and stay in our own communities and not get pushed out when the rent gets too high or new developments come in. I've lived in Portland for 5 years, and this has happened to me 3 times. I'm tired of moving, and it's better for all of us when we, when people can afford to live near where they work, have family, and can access the services that can help them improve their lives. I was an enlisted Army medic from 1977 to 80. And a staff nurse officer in the Air Force from 1987 to 90. I proudly served for the sake of my country, and also to help me get through nursing school, hoping one day to become a pediatric nurse practitioner. That's my passion. I became disabled while serving in the Air Force due to a number of medical complications caused by an undiagnosed disease called celiac disease, which is the most common genetic disorder. It's an autoimmune disease that is easily treated with diet. I broke several bones during my service, had surgery on my wrist, knee, ankle, along with a life-threatening sinus infection, which required major surgery, and two hospitalizations for allergic reactions. And I wanted to retire from the military after a full career of service, but I was too sick due to my undiagnosed genetic disorder. All those disabilities. Excuse me. I have been on SSD since 1997, and most of my income from SSD goes to medical expenses and the food I have to buy because my celiac disease, it costs more than twice the price of normal food. And because of my situation, I have specific housing needs, but wish to live in a safe, comfortable, and friendly community, just like anybody else. I would like an apartment on the ground floor with no stairs, a window to let in the sunshine, adequate heat, and a manager that treats me with respect. I presently don't have this. I would like to be able to walk to a grocery store. I will be walking. This is temporary. I broke my leg last week, had surgery, but I'll be walking again. I would like to be able to walk to a grocery store, go back to school, take art classes, and pursue my passions. I would like to live around families with children, neighbors of all different ages, backgrounds, and cultures. In a community like this, I would be less dependent on the TriMet lift, which would also save taxpayer money and give me greater freedom as well. Secure housing and opportunity would make all the difference in my life. Right now, I live in a neighborhood that fits many of my needs, but my rent is going up, and my landlord is trying to get me out because he doesn't want to deal with somebody with a disability. He tells me I belong in assisted living, but I am capable and independent and just want my own. I find it funny that he's diagnosing me. And just want my own place. If there were more opportunities for housing for me, I would spend less energy worrying about getting kicked out or where I'm going to land up next, and more energy volunteering, taking care of my health, and contributing to my community. There are many new apartment buildings and condos going up in my neighborhood right now, but nothing that I can afford. An inclusive housing policy could provide more choices and opportunity in my neighborhood and more for me and more people in situations like mine. I believe everyone can contribute to society and their communities in their own special way. Inclusive communities can offer housing opportunities to people of all different needs, family sizes, and incomes. It should be possible for military veterans, senior citizens, people with disabilities, and families to be able to afford living in the various beautiful communities that exist in Oregon. Inclusive housing would be one step to help us get there. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dorothy. Any quick questions? Thank you for your service, and thank you for coming today
and
testifying. So we have next Aaron Doyle, John Oster, and John Chandler. Just identify yourself and begin talking.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, Aaron Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities. The League is here in support of House Bill 2890 because we feel it addresses one of the fundamental goals of the land use and zoning systems, local control. Land use has consistently been considered a local issue that should be decided at the local level with local participants, local governments at the forefront. And this bill, by repealing this section, you allow the local governments to have that conversation about how to find appropriate, affordable housing for all of its residents. In addition, this is a big issue for a number of our cities to find other options for affordable housing to house the populations that they have now. And affordable housing is necessary for excellent economic development and community growth. So by repealing this section, you give one more tool to the toolbox of cities to find a way to address affordable housing. For this reason, we request a do pass vote out of the committee, and I am happy to answer any questions.
Any quick questions?
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. I understand what you're saying. I guess I'm struggling with this bill, something fierce. I'll just flat tell you. I'm just not hearing the evidence coming across here as it being, I get it as being a one more tool. And I'm not trying to be obstinate here or anything. I'm struggling with the bill itself. And my reasoning behind it is we all want affordable housing, or in a heartbeat we do. But I'm just not getting the idea of the transition here with repealing the bill and how it's going to work.
Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Olson, I think that when it's repealed, it'll be an opportunity for the local governments to look at what new options are available to them, to have that discussion in a public forum when they need to find other ways to address affordable housing other than incentive programs, which may or may not be working through something that maybe doesn't require a cash outlay, but through another mechanism of working with not only the folks who are affected by it, but the folks on both sides, both the people searching for affordable housing and those who would be providing it. So it would give the opportunity to have that conversation of what other tools are available that haven't been available to this point.
Okay, just a quick follow-up.
Sure.
Thank you. Okay, so what I'm hearing then is, would the final authority be, if it were repealed, the local government to make the final decision as to what occurs, even if there might be opposition to it and you're not able to find any common ground?
Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Olson, the current land use system has an appeals process on top of a local government would make a decision, particularly around zoning. There's often a planning commission that then goes to the city council. There's public involvement in all of that process. And then there's an appeals process up to LUBA and then to the courts to determine if what was provided was, in fact, within the realms of legal opinion. So it doesn't just end with the local government. But it should be where it starts.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, John.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Gumberg, and committee members. My name is John Oster. I'm the director of OPAL Environmental Justice Oregon, and
you need to tell us what OPAL is.
Organizing People Activating Leaders. We're an environmental justice and civil rights organization based in Portland, but with a little bit of statewide reach. I sit on the governor's environmental justice task force as the vice chair, and I've been tracking this issue for about 13-14 years now, since the initial prohibition was passed in 99. And I just want to speak very briefly about some of the history of how this bill came into effect and how to view it in a different context today. And perhaps Representative Olson also address some of your concern as well. It was interesting, I think, to hear Mayor Piercy talk about how the city of Eugene got together a bunch of diverse stakeholders to talk about visioning. And they had developers at the table, they had builders at the table, they had realtors, they had community stakeholders and constituents from all different sectors talking about how to best meet the needs of the city of Eugene. And yet there was this tool that they could not access. Now it's interesting because back in 1998, we were doing the same thing in Portland Metro. Metro, the regional government, had convened a housing technical advisory committee that had developers, that had home builders, that had realtors, that had a lot of community stakeholders and affordable housing advocates all around the same table to try to come up with a consensus for how to address the problem. And before that process was finalized, which was supposed to be the regional affordable housing strategy that was eventually issued in 2001, before that was done, while it was still in Metro's working committees, opposition to something like inclusionary zoning was able to marshal a bill through the legislature in 99 that closed that door. And so Metro had to take that tool out of the draft, out of the toolkit. And then when the regional affordable housing strategy was eventually published and promulgated in 2001, it wasn't included because the legislature had closed the door on that. And you've heard this by now multiple times. We're the only one of two states in the country that have precluded it, Texas being the other. There's about 400 some odd jurisdictions across the country that are using different forms of inclusionary zoning. The reason it's such a powerful and widespread tool is because it can be customized. So it doesn't look the same in two different locations. Every different jurisdiction can customize it and tweak it to best meet the needs of their local constituency. So if the local jurisdiction in Albany is looking to develop a strategy, they can convene a roundtable discussion with developers, with affordable housing advocates, with tenants, with users, consumers of affordable housing, and find out that right balance if they have the authority to do that. Now, right now, all that local jurisdictions have to do, the only authority that they have is to offer incentives, and it's not working. And you're going to hear from people who oppose inclusionary zoning and oppose this repeal that the home builders, the developers, the realtors, they're not the problem. It's the local jurisdictions that are the problem. The proponents of this bill, we don't believe that the developers are the problem. They're not the problem. They're part of the solution. But right now they're being precluded. We're all being precluded from having that conversation because the jurisdictions don't have that authority. There isn't that stick that's out there that people are mindful of. So right now all we've got is we've got a couple of incentives that we can dangle, and unless the stars align and unless the leverage is enough, like we had isolated examples in Portland Metro around urban renewal where we actually did have some local jurisdiction, we had some leverage, we were able to exact some set-asides in those developments, but those are one-offs. Those are the exceptions, those are not the norms. The norm is development goes up, it's a 25, 30 unit development, and the local jurisdictions have no leverage. They have no leverage. So we're not actually having a full, robust conversation around this. And the problem doesn't lie with any one sector. The problem lies in the fact that we are precluding ourselves from using all the tools that are at the disposal of every other jurisdiction in the country, with the exception of Texas. That's the real issue here. And so we want to be able to have customized policies on the ground that can meet the needs in whatever jurisdiction it is, because it's going to look different. And it's not as if the jurisdictions tell the developers, you have to sell your units at this price or rent your units at this price. The way that it's tweaked by different jurisdictions around the country is when we have a development going in, you look at the context of the region and you say, well, what's a large development? Because we typically don't see inclusionary housing working in small developments. This is only for the bigger developments. And so we say, okay, if we have a 30, a 40, a 50 unit development, we say in those developments, we're going to set aside just a few units at lower rates, at lower levels, so that we can have people from different socioeconomic backgrounds who can access this opportunity. That's all it is. We don't want to build for one small segment of society. We want everybody to be able to access all these benefits. So that's what we're looking to do by repealing this prohibition. And I'll take any questions.
Any questions?
Thank you. So you would place a deed restriction on 10 to 30% of new housing units in a subdivision, as I understand it.
Well, no.
Well, that's what it says in our measure summary here.
That's I'm not aware of that language, Representative Woodside. The repeal language is just repealing the state law that prohibits the use of inclusive housing policies. This isn't a referendum on what inclusive housing looks like in any jurisdiction. Every jurisdiction is going to have their own.
I just want to make clear, this is very poor. I'm sorry. This came, as I just heard from Wikipedia, this has nothing to do with this bill. This bill is not about inclusionary zoning. It just stops the prohibition of any kind of zoning that the city might impose.
So this This so is, summary, I apologize staff for this. Summary measure isn't.
No, no.
Okay.
So if I can read from the bill itself that hopefully you all have, it's just three lines. It repeals a provision that prevents local governments from imposing conditions on approved permits that effectively establish sales price for residential development or limit the purchase to a class or group of purchasers. So it's not requiring any government to do this, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. As we were told earlier, it puts one more tool in the toolbox of local government that might want to use something like this. But it does not require any kind of inclusionary zoning.
But it could, then, this might be one of the tools, because I'm trying to establish what are the tools we keep referring to. Mm-hmm. The tools, and I'm trying to understand what are the tools. Could you list us, is this one of the things that it could be a deed restriction on a part of the homes within a development then that makes it so that whoever buys those has to rent to low-income people?
So I because we're obviously talking about a hypothetical ordinance, I can just give you what the most general usage of this tool is nationally, is when you have a new development, and let's say it's a 50-unit apartment building going up, and the jurisdiction says, we want to put 15%, making up an arbitrary number, of those units, right, 7 or 8 units, at something other than market rate, typically 80 to 120% of the median household income, perhaps lower, right? So we say instead of having all 100%, all 50 units being sold at the market rate, whatever developer can get for it, we're going to just take some of those, 15% of those, 10%, 15%, and hold them off at a lower rate to make them accessible to people at from lower economic backgrounds. And in exchange, because we don't want to impose a cost on private developers. So in exchange for that, we're going to give you offsets as a developer. We're going to allow you to increase the amount of density. We're going to allow you to increase your floor area ratio. We're going to expedite permits. We're going to waive system development charges. We're going to do all these things to make sure that it pencils out for you, which is a societal investment that we're making. Because we care so much about the location of where affordable housing is, not so much the production. This isn't a affordable housing production tool as much as it's an equitable locational tool. And that's why it's so valuable to communities that want to use it. And if your community doesn't want to use it, and there's no one in your community that's pushing it, it's not going to happen. It just allows other jurisdictions to have that opportunity.
So would this preclude LCDC laws that we have in the state? Would this be outside of the laws that we have for the land use planning in the state?
Inclusive housing policies are consistent with Oregon's land use planning laws. It's not an exaction, if that's what you're referring to. It's not an unconstitutional taking, if that's what you're alluding to. And so, obviously, as a lawyer, I've done my homework on this, but I can't speak with the authority of a judicial opinion. But what I can say is that that using inclusive housing policies is consistent with land use laws in the state of Oregon. Wouldn't run afoul of any existing law.
Okay.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I went to go look up the statute that we're repealing, so I thought it would be worthwhile to put it on the record and then ask if I'm understanding it the correct way. So if we passed this bill, this language would go away, except as provided in subsection 2 of this section. A city, county, or metropolitan service district may not adopt a land use regulation or functional plan provision or impose as a condition for approving a permit requirement that has the effect of establishing the sales price for a housing unit or residential building lot or parcel, or that requires a housing unit or residential building lot or parcel to be designated for sale to any particular class or group of purchasers. So if we pass this bill, really all we're saying is that local jurisdictions can make local decisions about their housing priorities.
Can do what they're elected to do.
But it doesn't say anything about percentages or values. It puts it in the control of that local elected body.
Correct.
To make a decision consistent with all other land use, building code, and other laws of the state.
Correct.
Thank you.
Representative Gomberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I share your goals for affordable housing, and I heard what Representative Olson had to say. From where you're sitting, I sit a little bit to the left of where he is. But I still have some questions. And Representative Gelser read the first part of the section that we're repealing. I'm taking a look at the second part of that section, which says that the cities or counties, that nothing in this section would prevent them from implementing an incentive, a contract commitment, a density bonus, or other voluntary regulation, provision, or condition designed to increase the supply of moderate or lower cost housing units. So I'm trying to understand how removing that language gets us closer to the goal if this says that there's nothing here that prevents a city or a county or a service district from implementing rules that provide for affordable housing.
The key here is that what that subsection 2 refers to is incentive-based inclusive housing policies. So offering incentives to developers who would voluntarily agree to restrictions on their permit to further the goals of inclusive housing. And that is legal currently. And what I was trying to allude to earlier is that it's just not working. So in 99, the legislature passed this prohibition trying to solve a problem that didn't exist, frankly. There was no problem that was out there. It was a strategic political move by people who didn't want to see this come up down the road. And now we've actually had a housing crisis. Now we actually need these tools, and now we can't get them. And so what we've learned over the last 12 years, at least in the Portland metro region, which has the most urban development in the state, is that incentive-based programs just aren't working. They're not translating to units on the ground that are accessible to people at different socioeconomic backgrounds. And we have no shortage of examples of new condo developments, large developments going up, frankly, where we're not even seeing high vacancy rates because people can't afford to pay market rate to begin with. So even someone like myself at 80% of the MHI would struggle to live in one of those fancy new condo developments. And so all this would do is repeal the prohibition to use mandatory policies if the incentive-based policies aren't working. I think what we've seen nationally, and HUD actually, Housing and Urban Development, has a very strong analysis of this, is that incentive-based programs just aren't that effective. Where they are effective is when you have a mandatory policy that's in place, that gets everybody to the table. And then you can actually have a voluntary dialogue of what's going to work and what's best meets everybody's needs and work out a compromise. But without that leverage, we can't strike that right balance.
All right. Thank you very much. John.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, who is responsible for 197-309. In the first place, I appreciate Mr. Oster's recitation of events. A couple things in response to previous witnesses before I move on to my testimony. The first is I was struck by the number of folks who referred to the unique nature of Oregon law as being the only state aside from Texas that has a similar provision on the books. I didn't know that uniqueness was a detriment. I'm pleased to hear that. I assume we'll see a bill repealing Senate Bill 100 shortly, since we're the only state in the country that has that as well. I'm not going to hold my breath, Madam Chair, but I would point out that sometimes Oregon is unique in different ways, and I think this is an example of another good piece of policy. The other thing I want to mention is that we absolutely, my clients, I've been doing this for a long while, we absolutely support affordable housing. The witnesses you heard about the problems of non-inclusivity, of income separation, of social justice issues, we don't disagree with any of that. We believe that affordable housing is critical for our communities. We believe that having safe places to work and ways to walk in to school and all of that is critical to our communities. We simply object to having become our problem to fix. We did not create the problem. My industry did not create the problem. We do not set prices for the things that we build. The market sets prices for the things that we build. And the marketplace, as you all know, is a combination of all sorts of different factors, from cost of lumber to price of land to regulations on the ground to income levels of the community. We are a part of the solution, like Mr. Oster said, absolutely, but we object very strongly to being singled out to help fix it. And I want to call your attention to the statute that this bill would repeal. To kind of follow up that discussion, the latter part of Mr. Oster's testimony, he talked about incentives as an offsetting set of incentives for the mandate. That's legal today. That can be done today. What Mr. Oster described is perfectly legal under 197.309. The only thing that 197.309 says that the cities cannot do is set the price of the house. They cannot adopt policies that effectively set the sales price for a housing unit or residential building, lot, or parcel. That was why we brought the bill forward in 1999, because we saw the discussion going in a direction of saying, well, you know what, this is a really hard issue, and probably solving affordable housing is going to be expensive, and it's likely to irritate the neighborhoods, and people are going to show up and not want a condo, and they're not going to want apartments, and this is going to be tough. How about we make the builders do it? We didn't think that was a good idea then. We didn't think it was a good idea now. We believe that, in fact, I'll be perfectly honest with you, since we passed this bill, I expected conversations to happen with local governments about what are the tools in the toolkit, to use that phrase. What can we do? The conversation hasn't started. I would disagree that it hasn't worked. I would assert it hasn't begun in most communities. Portland is probably the furthest of anybody of trying to deal with this issue, and even Portland has a lot of things they could do a lot differently, or perhaps said differently, policy choices the city has made that have effects on housing and have effects on neighborhoods that perhaps in retrospect weren't all that wise to begin with. This is a very complicated issue, Madam Chair and members. It is an extraordinarily complicated issue. It has a lot of moving parts. It is not susceptible to any one solution. I gave you, as part of my testimony, a one-pager, and I want to stress on the record, I put it in writing, I want to stress it here, this is just a thinking out loud from myself and one of the staff attorneys for 1,000 Friends of Oregon. It's not company policy for either one of our organizations, because to represent it otherwise might be a career-limiting move for both of us, because there's things on this list that both of our groups have historically opposed. Having said that, we sat down, I don't know which conversation it was, probably 4 or 5 years ago, and decided that what could we do to increase density? What could we do to increase affordability? And there's close to 24 ideas there. Most cities in Oregon don't use very many of them. They're all legal today. They would all fit within the rubric of 197.309. They would all, I believe, have some effect on the cost of housing, on density, on the type of urban form that some of the previous witnesses have talked about. It is not our fault that local governments aren't adopting these. It simply isn't. And as I said in my testimony that I've distributed, we have philosophical objections, and that's one of the primary ones. We're being asked to bear a burden, to pay a price, to solve a problem that is everybody's problem. Representative Reardon is absolutely right. That's what we said in 1999. This is a societal problem. This is not an industry problem. It's not a Portland problem. It's an Oregon problem. And there's culpability all around. There are laws on the books that, had they been enforced, could have helped this issue. There are laws on every city council's ordinance books that, had they been enforced, could address this issue. We collectively, if you don't mind my saying that, are all responsible. It doesn't help to say we're going to make builders take a loss, or, said differently, landowners take a loss, or, said even differently, people who buy new houses pay more. Because under any example you think of, if you're going to set aside some number of units, if there's an offsetting benefit to the developer, to the builder, to the property owner, it's legal today. If there isn't that, if there's a mandatory program with no offset, A, I think it's unconstitutional, with all due respect to my colleague to my left, it's certainly unjust. And what that does then is, by allowing those affordable units to be sold at whatever the price might be, whatever percentage it might be, somebody else has to pay for that if the project's going to succeed. Because, as you all know, any business venture has to cover its costs and show a reasonable profit. It's going to come out of the developer's pocket. It's going to come out of the pockets of the people who buy the above-market, now-priced units. And what we've done, essentially, is focus a very rifle-shot tax on the people who build or buy new houses to solve this societal problem. That's why the language in the statutes exists. That's why we brought the bill forward in 1999. That's why I'm here today asking you, please do not delete that. But not stop there. Let's go have the conversation that we should have been having about how this works, how to make it some of these tools in place. I was reading a fascinating article on Sightline blog, which was new to me. It's a sustainability blog based out of Seattle, looks at Cascadia, as they call it, up and down the West Coast. Talking about accessory dwelling units, I don't recall the URL off the top of my head. There's a wonderful, I think it's a 10 or 11 part series on accessory dwelling units and how easily it could be to increase density in community, increase diversity of housing in a community simply by allowing accessory dwelling units. They're often called granny flats, where you put a cottage next to the house or on top of the garage or in the garage, for that matter. Most cities dramatically restrict those. City of Salem, for example, doesn't allow them at all. Other cities make you do 3 backflips and eat a bug in order to get one approved. That's just one simple idea that could work to increase a lot of the housing, the cost of housing, the diversity of housing types. The other thing I want to leave you with, committee, is a pledge. As this conversation goes forward, I've talked to a number of the advocates and some of the legislators who signed on the legislation. And what I find fascinating about this conversation, unlike some of the ones we've had in previous years on this topic, the issue is not as much affordability per se as it is social equity, whether or not you're mixing communities of income or isolating communities of income, whether or not you're putting all the affordable housing on one side of town and leaving the other part of town untouched. That's a real problem. It's been a problem in the Portland area, I know, for many, many years. That's one that ought to be solved, that we ought to talk about how to fix. I think, if anything, inclusionary zoning, or the mandatory inclusionary zoning, might move you away from that, because it's likely to gravitate towards where the land is less expensive than where the land is most expensive, and the land is likely less expensive in the parts of town that are getting tired of having the low-income housing in the first place. But I think that discussion, perhaps involving the city of Portland and others where that problem exists, would be a very valuable one to have and to start up, perhaps involving the state housing agency, perhaps involving LCDC, to talk about how do we structure our communities differently. Because quite frankly, what you're dealing with here, as much as anything else, is a system where policy choices were made for good reason. And we're oftentimes, as you know, you've seen this in your career in the legislature, you deal between good policy and good policy and choosing between those, not good policy and bad policy. And I'll give you 3 real quick examples. We have one of the toughest building codes in the country. We have probably the most rigorous energy code, depending on who you talk to, but it's certainly one of the top 3, and I'm not quarreling with that. And by the way, any of the things I'm going to mention here, these are all things we support or we're fine with. We think having a good building code is important. It has energy efficiency is important. We lower our carbon footprint. We have more comfortable homes and so forth. That is more expensive for us to build than it is in other parts of the country. We have an urban growth boundary. We support the urban growth boundaries. We think they're a good planning tool, but they decrease the supply of land. And if you decrease the supply of land and you increase or keep the demand constant for any commodity, the price is going to go up. Does that mean you don't do urban growth boundaries? It doesn't. But it means that you have to recognize that there needs to be a certain effect on prices. And since when you're dealing with affordability issues, that's one of the things you might want to think about. System development charges are used extensively by local governments, and I'm not quarreling with that either. We have agreed to, we helped write the system development charge in 1989, the statute that's on the books that authorizes them. The problem is, there are very few tools available to local governments because we've taken the policy as a state of limiting property taxes. This body did not, but the voters did. As a result, in many places in Oregon, it's over $50,000 of system development charges before you start building a house. That makes it difficult to have affordable housing. And these are not, I'm not saying these are things, if we fix those, the issue goes away. I'm saying we've made policy choices. And they were good policy choices and understandable policy choices. They simply had other effects. And what we probably ought to do, rather than try to rifle shot it again, is to go back and have that bigger conversation. What can we do differently? How can we think about this issue differently? How can we start evaluating our policy choices in a more holistic manner, rather than find out 5, 10, 15 years later, whoops, that one didn't work. Let's try it again. Madam Chair, members, we really do believe this is a bad policy to delete this statute. We believe it's bad housing policy. We think it's unfair to our industry, certainly. We think it blames a segment that's doing nothing more than what they have a legal right to do of building houses or buying houses, and instead is really a non-answer for a very important problem. We would encourage you to not move this bill forward, but I would pledge to you our support in discussing this issue and trying to come up with some other method of addressing what is clearly a social problem that is long overdue for conversation. Be glad to take questions.
Any questions?
I have a question.
Representative Kenny-Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John, just in the question about local versus state control with the granny flats, is there any prohibition right now on the state, on a city like Eugene, making a decision on that?
Madam Chair, Representative Kenny-Geyer, no.
Okay. And on the system development charges right now, our state allows local jurisdictions to make their own policy over system development charges.
Madam Chair, right? Yes, correct.
Okay. Are you aware of any other tools besides this one where the state says you're, as a local jurisdiction, not allowed to make that decision?
Oh, heavens, yes. Madam Chair, a city cannot decide to move the urban growth boundary on farmland. Mm-hmm. Just pick one at random.
Mm-hmm.
We've tried to run a bill a few years ago, along with other groups, that would have allowed affordable housing provision as a criteria for urban growth boundary expansion, and it did not pass. Again, I'm not quarreling with the outcome there. I could have put it on my list of policy choices we have made
mm-hmm.
That cause an impact on the price of housing.
Mm-hmm. And if this were passed,
Okay.
If this were passed, and a city such as Portland or a region such as Metro decided to pass an ordinance allowing this, it would be applied equally, I'm assuming, and maybe this is for Mr. Oster as well. You wouldn't say to one development, you have to have a certain amount of below market units. You would have to make an ordinance that would apply to all units over, for instance, 30 units, right? It would be applied equally, and then the housing developer would be voluntary whether you would want to build there. It would be voluntary that people would want to buy into that. Is that correct? It's applied equally. It's not this development has to follow this rule, and we're going to make
Chair,
it.
Madam Chair, Reverend Kinnegar, I'll answer that part of the question. Yes, it would have. I think it would have to be applied equally, or at least within some band of criteria, unless they thought their city attorney needed something to do.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, panel, very much. And we have Sean Gilliams and Justin somebody, the answer to the B, and Greg Malinowski. Oh, there's no I at the end.
Unless you're from Poland, it's Malinowski.
Listen, doesn't it? Just end it with a K. Okay. And gentlemen, thank you so much for coming. And I'm going to ask you to be sort of quick because we have three more bills coming up. So, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Gilliams representing the Oregon Association of Realtors in opposition to House Bill 2890. And I think you heard a lot of discussion about affordable housing and the needs of people. We're certainly supportive of that. There's no bigger industry that promotes home ownership than ours. I think what we disagree with is this particular tool and how it's utilized. I think you heard a lot of discussion already about the voluntary nature of how these programs could work and that they're not. Mr. Chandler mentioned that pilot project that was proposed, that was several years ago, and LCDC Chair John Van Landingham actually championed the thought of being able to do a pilot project for limited affordable housing as a basis for expanding the urban growth boundary so that you could perhaps get the land for less expensive in exchange for affordable housing, and that was killed rather quickly in this building. I'm not even positive it had a public hearing on it. If it did, it had one. I would also rewind a little bit, Madam Chair, and go back to a work group that Mr. Chandler, our group, and the affordable housing advocates had outside of this building in 2008, where we got together and we actually hired a mediator to come in and talk about our issues and say, okay, we spent a lot of time fighting in the Capitol. We all agree on the need for affordable housing. How can we address it? And the result of that actually was the document recording fee, which was a $15 increase in the document recording fee dedicated strictly to affordable housing programs. We all supported that. We came into this building and said, while we have differences on other approaches, we all agree on this, and let's go forward with this $15 document recording fee. So that was just in 2009 that we tried to address this situation, and we created a dedicated revenue source for affordable housing programs, which previously did not exist in Oregon, that dedicated revenue source. And in fact, Madam Chair, I'm sure you guys are familiar with that because you expanded that document recording fee this session by $5 to do veterans housing as well. So I think that we have tried to work on different things where we could all come to agreement, affordable housing advocates, realtors, home builders. This is one of those issues that we don't agree and we agree to disagree on it. We do believe in voluntary incentive-based systems. We do believe and have seen in other places. Some of you know I spent some time living in Southern Nevada and lobbying down there for a city where we actually did implement voluntary incentive-based, and we would increase the density for development developer beyond their original proposal in exchange for them providing X number of units. That certainly is allowable under the current law. With that, Madam Chair, I'm sure I've taken up more than the 2 minutes I should have. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Sean. We're going to hear from the other two folks, and we'll take questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Burry, and I'm the Deputy Director of the Community Alliance of Tenants, Oregon's only statewide membership-based grassroots tenant-controlled tenants' rights organization. CAT is a tenant member organization with over 2,000 members statewide. Low-income tenants, predominantly people with families with children, people living with disabilities, low-wage workers, seniors, and people of color are CAT's primary membership base. We believe that all Oregonians should have access to safe and stable housing and be able to live in the communities with good schools, transportation options, healthcare services, and economic opportunity. Since our inception, our members have identified the lack of affordable housing as a barrier to their stability, safety, and opportunity. The majority of our constituents are paying well over 50% of their income on rent, many paying over 70% on rent. Low-income tenants have far fewer options of where they can live and are unable to move to areas of opportunities that can help them improve their lives. This is a problem throughout the state. In Oregon, 37% of households rent their home. For extremely low-income Oregonians, there's a shortage of over 100,000 affordable and available units in the state. Additionally, in Oregon, the average fair market rent for a two-bedroom is $832, and a minimum wage worker earns $8.95 per hour. This worker would have to work 72 hours per week, 52 weeks a year, to afford the average rent of an average two-bedroom apartment. Unfortunately, the statewide ban on inclusionary zoning housing ordinances have restricted our ability to provide affordable housing in areas of high opportunity. Demographic data shows that residents with low incomes have very few options but to live in concentrated areas of low opportunity. And over the past 14 years, our communities have become more segregated by income, race, disability, and family size. If cities and counties had a tool of inclusionary housing available to them, these housing patterns would have been avoided. Recent news reports have thoroughly documented how various residents and communities are locked out of new housing opportunities. While there are numerous causes for this problem, the ban on inclusive housing is a significant contributor. Under the status quo, the only affordable housing that gets developed is with government funding. These public resources have always been insufficient to meet our housing needs, and they are shrinking every year. This means that cities, counties, and nonprofit housing developers focus on developing in the least expensive land available. And not surprisingly, this land is generally located in areas that already have high concentrations of poverty, with fewer job opportunities and things like grocery stores, transportation options, and good schools that help people succeed in life. The existing system simply reinforces non-inclusive housing patterns. An inclusive housing ordinance would allow for development of affordable housing and new housing projects regardless of the cost of land. It shifts the burden off of public resources and provides for diverse communities that benefit us all. An inclusive housing policy provides safe, accessible, and affordable housing in communities of high opportunities by allowing local governments to work with housing developers to set aside a percentage of new units at below market rates or contribute to an affordable housing fund. In exchange, developers receive benefits that can reduce construction costs and encourage business. Local governments can tailor their own inclusive housing policies to fit the housing needs, zoning codes, and real estate markets of their own particular jurisdiction. Local control of affordable housing strategies supports our belief that problem solving can best occur where people have a better chance to have a direct say in the decisions that impact their lives. This statewide preemptive ban is an unnecessary constraint that severely limits a local jurisdiction's options to work directly with the people most affected by these problems and to direct solutions. Cities and counties should decide what's best affordable housing strategy for their own needs and markets. Currently, over 300 jurisdictions throughout the U.S. utilize an inclusive housing policy to support their housing needs. And this also means that there are thousands of jurisdictions where an inclusive policy is not needed or wanted. We agree that an inclusive housing policy is good for some communities, but maybe not for others. If one community wants to use this tool, the residents living there should have the opportunity to assess its benefits and decide for themselves. And it wouldn't affect the community next door or across the state. The statewide ban is overly restrictive and regulatory. we need to give back local control so cities and counties have their freedom to make their own decisions. The Oregon state legislature has enough important issues to address that are appropriate at the statewide level, and local inclusive housing policy should be decided at the local level so members of this community and your colleagues can focus on other issues. Hardworking families should have the opportunity to remain in communities and stay involved and contribute to their health and vitality. Often tenants are involuntarily displaced from their communities due to rising property values and rents. If new developments in an area were to provide more mixed-income housing options, this would not only reduce displacement, but maintain vital community networks and promote equal opportunities for all Oregonians. I'm going to speak candidly for a little bit here in response. you know, the Mr. Chandler before talked about the fact that
This is not a debate.
I apologize. I just wanted to mention that this policy is overly restrictive, and we shouldn't be holding cities, counties hostage in order to address some of the other policies that certain oppositions may disagree with.
Thank you.
Greg Malinowski, Washington County Commissioner, District 2. I'm not speaking for the whole county. I'm speaking for my district elected rep, and I also have an email from the Dick Scouten in District 1 saying go for it. So in any case, my experiences with the exclusionary law, we have a lot of high-end opportunities out in North Bethany and in my district for new housing. We've recently okayed about 4,200 new units up there. The situation we've got is that when I go to ask or beg or however you want to look at it, what they can do about putting some lower-priced housing in the area, the very first or second statement I get is, you know, I'm a member of the home builders, and we had a law passed to prevent that. And so that kind of cuts the discussion off, because I can say, yes, well, but you could still do it. Yeah, but we don't have to. And I hear that from all of them, from every one of them. So, you know, to say that this is a law that doesn't impact anything and we could figure out other ways. When that 800 acres of farmland came in, Metro stipulated that we would have 20% at 60% of the average wage, average wage, and 20% at 80%. And so when we went ahead and urbanized that and put the zoning on it, we managed, the board majority managed to ask for our county attorney to put together a plan that would do that, that would not actually have to any impact on anything. And he had mentioned he had to get Metro to sign off on it, and by golly, he did. And he handed it over to us, and he said, here's the good news. You can approve this and put it on the shelf and never look at it again. So on the ground, for us elected officials who are trying to make a difference for affordable housing, that's what we're running into. And it would be really nice if you would pull the teeth on this for us. I've talked to him about affordable, and I've had a gentleman tell me, you know, I build 2,500 to 4,000 square foot homes. In order for me to make them affordable, like you're wanting, I would have to make them out of cardboard in order to make money. All right? I don't want any cardboard. What I want is that out of 4,200 homes is I want some that are 1,200 square feet for folks that are starting out, couples starting out, and for empty nesters. I want some 800 footers for kids starting out who aren't even couples yet, or for somebody on the high side of 70 who finds himself alone. I've got people in a 50-year-old subdivision that are don't want to do their yards anymore. They're 60s and 70s, and they want to move out. They can't get another place right in there. You know, hundreds of homes, and they can't get one that's smaller for them. They have to leave. They live there the whole time. I've been told we don't need affordable housing everywhere because we've got one or two neighborhoods, and that's where, you know, people who don't work hard enough to deserve to live in the nice areas can go. In the meantime, they got to drive 30 minutes to get to the nice area to work. They work in restaurants, baristas, there are medical people. I want to make sure that in this new community of 4,200 homes, which might be about 10,000 people, that deputies who patrol the streets can afford to live there. We have a school right in the middle of it. I want to make sure the teachers who work in that school can afford to live there. We have easy access and walkable to malls and little commercial things that we've got planned for that neighborhood. I want to make sure that not only the customers can walk there, but it'd be really nice if the people who work there could walk there. I don't want to have to figure out how to build a bunch of roads to get all the working class people from one spot out, you know, 30 minutes away to all the other spots so they can do the work that we all expect them to do. This exclusionary thing is a hindrance. We need this. I don't know how we'd use it. I'm not in favor of subsidized housing. I'm not in favor of building cheap housing for poorer people. Just make it smaller. Instead of putting 100 square feet of marble in this house, make it 800 square feet and put 10 or 12 square feet. Make it nice, just make it smaller. And I think if we have that stair step, I think we'll be able to have a mixed community of people of all ages. And but I need to get past the hurdle that shuts me down when they say, you know, our group had this law passed and we don't have to do this. And it's like, okay. Now, we did offer incentives. And let me tell you, those guys came in and brought their lawyers and said, we want these incentives. We're unhappy with the fact that you're mandating that we build some affordable housing to get them. So we want you to change the rules to allow the incentives to work, but just not for affordable housing. So, and they have the political pressure to do that because in the end our hands are kind of tied. So I'm just, you know, to me, I'm not a fan of subsidized housing. Sooner or later, any check from the government stops. I would just like to see us have those different price breaks in quality housing so that we can have a complete neighborhood for everybody. Not just people who can live in a house from 2,500 to 4,000 square feet. And this is hanging us up, frankly. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you for coming. Thank you, all the whole panel, for coming. Let me see if there are any quick questions. Representative Whitsitt.
I'm just trying to understand when we establish property taxes in a neighborhood, we go by comparables. I believe maybe Mr. Jillians can help me with this. And so if we take a neighborhood and then we put in a below market value on some of the houses, does this diminish the overall property tax of the comparables? I'm looking at the revenue stream for K-12. If we start dropping low-income housing into larger subdivisions that have, does it drop the whole property tax value of that entire subdivision by setting prices arbitrarily low on some of it?
And my goal is not to set them arbitrarily low. My goal is to say that instead of building a 3,000 square foot home, if you build an 800 square foot home, you can sell it cheaper. You don't have the cost tied up into it. You've got more density. So you've got areas with no density and these with density. I don't believe that we need to freeze the value of that. Just the fact that there's 800 square foot and a 1,200 square foot location and a 3,000 square foot opportunity, they'll be cheaper than each other. And it's not because we're holding the price down artificially. It's because 800 square feet is cheaper to buy than 3,000 square feet. So it allows the market to function.
I think that's a legitimate question. What I'm going to ask is that somebody in the audience will be able to get that information to us. And I'm sorry, we have to close this hearing. Thank you so much for coming. Thanks for all who came to testify. We're closing the first public hearing on House Bill 2890. We're opening a work session on Senate Bill 203.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 203 has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. It clarifies that low-income consumer is defined by Public Utility Commission by rule. It declares an emergency effective upon
it. I probably didn't word it.
We have an amendment to Senate Bill 22A.
It's part of it.
Clean.
I mean, I get what they're saying.
Okay.
It's really good. Okay. Yeah. Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 203 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves Senate Bill 203 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Madam Chair, very quickly, I had asked some questions earlier during the hearing on this regarding a section in the bill that I wondered whether had a substantive effect. Staff did follow up on that. I just want to indicate that I was satisfied that it was not substantive and that we can move forward with this just fine.
Thank you. All right. Will the clerk call the roll, please?
Joe? You were asked to vote.
Oh, I'm sorry. Aye.
We were discussing something, Your Honor.
Senate Bill 203. Go call the rest of the roll. Go ahead.
Cell phone bill.
Yep.
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Excused.
Representative Kenny
Geyer?
Aye. Representative Wisnin?
Aye.
Representative Whitson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bomber?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Could we call him Representative Gallegos, please?
Aye.
Yes. The measure passes. Thank you, colleagues. Grove.
Do you want to carry her?
Oh, sure. Representative Gomberg, why don't you carry this one since you asked the good question? All right.
That'll teach me.
That'll teach you. All right, now we're going to close the work session on 203, open up Senate Bill, work session on Senate Bill 22A.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 22A has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. It updates the statutory language to describe rights of persons with developmental disabilities who are receiving developmental disability services from the Department of Human Services. It removes references to Eastern Oregon Training Center and references to operation of State Training Center by Department of Human Services. It requires Department of Human Services to promote dispute resolution procedures for individuals receiving developmental disability services.
And we do have an amendment, correct?
That's right. There is a -2 amendment in everyone's packet.
Great.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move that we adopt the -2 amendments of the Senate Bill 22.
Representative Olson moves to adopt the -2 amendments dated 3/15/13 to Senate Bill 22A. Any discussion? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 22A as adopted to the House floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Olson moves that Senate Bill 22A as amended be reported out of committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, would the clerk call the roll, please?
Representative Gago?
Yes.
Representative
Gelser? Yes. Excused?
Dyer.
Aye.
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 Bomber.
Aye.
Aye. What do you think about this going as the consent agenda? Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. You know what? I'll be truthful with you. I'll carry it. I prefer it's
okay.
Not.
All right. Representative Olson will carry. With that, the measure passes. Thank you. And now I open up the informational hearing on the Law Enforcement Data System, LEDS, and Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Andy Olson, state representative from the Albany area. And Madam Chair, you'll clearly remember what House Bill 3664 was all about 4 years ago. And Representative Gelser, you'll remember that too from 2 years earlier when we all got a chance to go down to Albany to have that one town hall, actually a traveling committee hearing.
Madam Chair, I remember that day well because my niece was born that day while we were having it.
That's a good thing. That's a good memory then. All right. Well, we're, you know, and Madam Chair, I really appreciate you allowing and giving us this opportunity here real quickly. And I'm just going to open this up to the point of where are we at today?
For the folks who don't know what that legislation
okay.
did.
I think well, we essentially what we did, and you're going to be getting this... Frank Moore, he's the director from the Linn County Health Department is going to be passing out this. This is something that Department of Human Services created as a result of what we did with 3664. Basically, what it does is it allows on a voluntary basis someone who has a medical condition. We started out initially with the mental health side, but we expanded it to a number of folks too that were involved with medical conditions like diabetes, dementia, and to move through filling this form out, and by doing so, then it would be that information would be entered into the law enforcement data system that the state police maintain. That way, if you have an incident where a loved one that had their name entered into the system was stopped by a law enforcement officer by chance, you'd be able to quickly find determine what is happening with that individual. You have here today a number of folks that can kind of give you a lot better update on what's happening with this program. I really appreciate that you have two members from the Washington County Sheriff's Office that will be here too, and they've really learned to try to kind of step up and be more involved in that community for the medical side of it, as well as the mental health side too, for reaching out. But you have also some directors too from different counties to kind of paint this picture. We spent a lot of time, a lot of work on this, and there was a lot of folks that were involved to get to this point. And I'm just going to give you a real quick example of one of the things that occurred about 5-6 years ago. Lady, an older lady that was from the metropolitan area, had was experiencing dementia. She was traveling through Newburgh. Was stopped by a city police officer there, issued a citation for reckless driving. She was looking for Estacada. The officer gave her directions how to get to Estacada. And in the meantime, a couple hours later, she gets stopped again by another police officer over in Canby, gets issued a citation for reckless driving. She's still looking for Estacada. But what had happened is that she didn't know where she was at. Family members didn't know where she was at. I'm just saying that, and that's what created this database issue for the connection for law enforcement to be in a position to help, as well as family members to feel a little bit more security with those that are, you know, suffering from a condition, that have this information available. When you do this search through the computer system, you know who to contact and resolve a problem. And that's what this was all designed about. That's how simple it was. So I'm going to let others come up, Madam Chair, and move this.
Any quick questions of Representative Olson? Yes,
this may be a question for you or somebody that comes later. This sounds fantastic, and I'm sure there were a lot of discussions about how do you keep the information confidential. So whether you or somebody else brings that up, I'd love to know how you resolve
it. There will be several that will share that with you. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Representative Whitsett.
Yeah.
Wait, Representative Olson.
You can't get away. it's a voluntary.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, now you go. Thank you. So we have Frank Morris, Silas Halloran, and Kristen Burke.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei, Vice Chairs Gomberg and Olson, members of the House Human Services Committee. For the record, my name is Frank Moore. I'm the Health Administrator and Mental Health Director for Linn County, and I should add a proud constituent of State Representative Andy Olson. So with that, I think the reason I'm here, and I'm probably mostly, I think, the fluff in terms of the introduction of the bill, because I worked with Representative Olson closely on this when it initially rolled out in another form in the 2007 session, and then we actually worked alongside a number of different agencies and advocacy groups to pass it in 2009. My piece of it is that I do believe it's a bill as implemented and when more fully implemented that could truly save lives. When I take a look back at my programs, however, in retrospect, what I would have to say that I am somewhat embarrassed that Linn County has not implemented it to the full extent that it could. And I began to wonder. Initially, I thought, well, maybe that's just passive resistance on the part of my peers or my staff when it comes to working with people with mental illness or developmental disabilities. But what I believe it is more probably related to what I see as the beginning of some of the changes that we will see with the health transformation and with coordinated care organizations, and a change in the culture of treatment providers from one of what I would see as more or less paternalistic, in that we know what's best for individuals, whether it's physical health care or behavioral health care, to one that truly informs individuals of their rights and their choices when it comes to their health care. It's the kind of changes that I see when I visit my physician here in Salem. Instead of him telling me what to do, he's quite frankly asking me more frequently, well, what do you want to do? I don't think people with developmental disabilities or mental illness are any different. Even in a court of law, when a person is civilly committed, they're not deemed to be incompetent, and they still have a right to make choices. So I think that I look forward to a much, much broader implementation. I think when Silas Hauensteiner from Yamhill County talks, you'll see a system where I think he's done a much better job of implementing it with the population and has many more people registered in the database than I do. And my hopes are that as we move forward in the health transformation and truly inform people of their opportunities and their rights, this should be considered an integral part of what they learn about, and that they should have a choice, an opportunity to make those choices. So with that, I will defer to Cheryl Ramirez, the Executive Director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Skomberg, Olson, and members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Ramirez. I'm the Director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. And in preparation for this hearing, I polled our membership, which includes community mental health program directors and health and human services directors, to ask them about their current implementation of LEDS. 14 of the directors responded, and they represented both rural and urban counties. About 50% were not using LEDS, 50% were. Those who weren't using or who aren't currently using LEDS cited several barriers. The most common barrier regarded the consent issues, both resistance on the part of the individual with mental illness and on the providers who ask the individuals. There was the perception about the use of the information to punish rather than to assist individuals with mental illness. Another respondent talked about security reasons for not using the database, and when I asked further about what that meant, it wasn't just the consent and privacy issues, it was concern about the process being cumbersome, having to check the office for security requirements, the process when you're changing the contact person, for example. But in general, it was really what came out from those counties that weren't using it was their perception that there was a basic mistrust of law enforcement among individuals with mental illness. For those who are currently using LEDS, there is modest enrollment, as Frank mentioned. We have everything from about 1 to 17 individuals currently signed up. And when we're talking about the individuals, these are only people with mental illness or other qualifying conditions under this bill is what we're talking about. Although they're using LEDS, these counties, they mentioned a couple of barriers besides the consent issues, which they have too. The web form was not easy to use, and in some counties, and I know probably Silas will talk about this, they adapted the form to make it more user-friendly, for example. Other recommendations that would make the process easier to implement would be increased funding for the office, for both at the county level and for the state office. additional training for the staff so that those who are directly involved with this program understand the purpose of the system. And one other comment was that LEDS does not include crimes handled by municipal court, and I'm not personally sure, you know, how big that is. So to take a systems view, I would say that consistent implementation of LEDS really makes sense. Considering the huge healthcare transformation that Oregon is going through with coordinated care, and the commitment that we've made as a state to USDOJ to settle the Olmstead lawsuit, because it does include individuals who are involved in the criminal justice system, it makes sense that law enforcement, like Frank mentioned, should be a partner in sharing information, health information, just like the other local partners, the community mental health system, the CCOs, and the fact that with Medicaid expansion, which I'm assuming will pass in Oregon, will mean that, and these are according to national figures, that an estimated 45% of the individuals involved in the criminal justice system and with behavioral health conditions will be Medicaid eligible. And that is really a huge population that we're talking about. And I would predict that coordinated care organizations will want to have their health information, will want to share health information with law enforcement for these individuals. So I would say that it's very important for public safety to become partners, and this is, I mean, not only with the LEDS, but in the whole system. You know, there are a lot of aspects of the system. There are a lot of jail diversion efforts. This is one particular component of jail diversion. And I think it's the only way we'll reach the health outcomes and the health cost reduction that we've committed to CMS. And it's the only way that we'll reach the promises, really, that we've committed to the USDOJ in our settlement agreement. So with that, I'd like to have Silas talk about a county that's been successful in implementing LEDS.
Madam Chair Tomei and members of the committee, we have implemented this locally. My name is Silas Hollerensteiner. I'm the Director of Health and Human Services for Yamhill County. And we are still implementing, and at the beginning, I appreciate my colleagues pointing to Yamhill County as a leader. We have enrolled 17 individuals, and I want to just clearly state that the goal is to allow greater choices for the individuals living in our community who recognize the value of entering this medical information into LEDS. So it's completely voluntary. It's been well received by local law enforcement and other partners, including the Yamhill County chapter of our National Alliance on Mental Illness, this local NAMI chapter, but only after discussions about how the information will be used and what constitutes consent. So the 17 individuals range in ages from 7 to 56. Six of them are self-enrolled individuals with serious mental illness, five of whom have had significant history of interface with the criminal justice system. The other 11 individuals were referred by parents, guardians, or caregivers and enrolled in the county's developmental disabilities program. It's important to note that under our policy, individuals and or their guardians can remove their information at any time with written notice. So I'm borrowing a phrase from our presiding judge, Circuit Court Judge John Collins, if any of you know him. Mm-hmm. And he uses this phrase to talk about the criminal justice system. And he's a great mentor, and I love the phrase. And he talks about we need better outcomes sooner. Three words, better outcomes sooner. So having the LEDS medical database information available for law enforcement follows the spirit of better outcomes sooner. And it allows criminal justice system diversion for persons whose primary issues are really mental health challenges and other developmental disabilities, not criminal conduct. It allows for quicker engagement and possible entry into needed services if individuals are disorganized or symptomatic. It allows for improved safety for individuals and law enforcement personnel both by preparing officers and deputies before entering a crisis situation. And lastly, it allows for access to emergency contact information of family, caregivers, and others for some of our most vulnerable.
There are, however, as colleagues to my left have mentioned, some implementation challenges that we've experienced, and I'll share a few of those. One was the issue with entry of the data into the LEDS system and the certification process that's fairly laborious for a local community mental health program to work on and stay certified. And for anybody I've worked in, was certified parole and probation officer at a point in my career and have been LEDS certified, and it is, for all the right reasons, a lot of security is necessary in order to be able to maintain that certification. So we've worked around that in a couple different ways. I'll cover that in a moment. The other big barrier has been cultural, and largely it hasn't been the family members, the parents, or even the individuals as much as it's been the mental health staff. And I think that largely it's been around ethical dilemmas, citing confidentiality laws, and this pervasive concern that somehow the information would be misused or could be misused. So in order to overcome these obstacles to implementation, we've spent a lot of time identifying the value internally with staff as well as reaching out to the local NAMI chapter. We've worked with the director of LEDS directly, Terry O'Connell, and entered the information directly through LEDS, not local, because I tried that first and we hit some barriers. But now we have an MOU in place, memorandum of agreement with our local sheriff's office, and they're entering the information for us so that we're not fully certified as a CMHP, as a community mental health program. So the opportunities are huge for increased health and safety, but it really requires a comprehensive approach that goes beyond just having information in a LEDS medical database, and I want to name a few of those things. So one of them is crisis intervention training for law enforcement. Locally, our Sheriff Jack Crabtree is really invested in CIT, and they've sent 26 deputies and 7 sergeants for training. It makes a difference day-to-day in terms of how we partner and work with local law enforcement. Our municipal PDs and the local state police are also making investments. We've also really increased outreach efforts by the community mental health professionals who work in tandem with local law enforcement, and those are investments that we need to continue to make statewide. And then the other significant opportunity this provides is immediate access to the information, and again, trust that this information will be used for better outcomes sooner. So we've got successes, mainly anecdotal at this time. I did talk with the patrol captain of the Newburgh Police Department earlier this week, and he reported that an officer had used the database last week to resolve an issue without incarceration or hospitalization. I believe we can significantly improve our response to persons with disabilities and mental health challenges with greater use of this database. And at the core of this system's change is the needed investment by community leaders, policymakers, practitioners, advocacy groups, and others. This is hard work that must be done over time and with community cohesion and partnership as guiding principles. So in summary, I have the following recommendations, again, in order to achieve better outcomes sooner. 4 things. 1, fund crisis outreach specialists who are embedded with local law enforcement, if possible and when possible. We really have a crisis system that right now is pretty busting at the seams in terms of making sure that we do assessment and triage for acute care hospitalization, civil commitment, and any alternatives like crisis respite, rapid psychiatric evaluation. We're doing those things in the community. We aren't statewide doing the mobile outreach, and in small communities, it's really hard to do that without additional funding. Secondly, invest in CIT for law enforcement so that agencies don't have to choose between enforcement activities and mental health training for officers and deputies. I think that's a difficult choice for local law enforcement to make. Thirdly, continue voluntary consent for enrollment in LEDS, but make participation mandatory for community mental health programs if and only if funds can be identified to support this activity. Again, small communities will really struggle with this if we're not able to support them. And fourth, require community mental health programs to partner with sheriff's offices or Oregon State Police to enter information into LEDS to avoid some of the administrative burden that's required through the certification process. Thank you for your interest in this topic, and please let us know if you want more information.
Any quick questions? Thank you for your work. Thank you for coming to testify. So we had Cheryl, right? And so now we're having Ron Medlock. Did I call up Kristen Burke? Okay, good. Bill Steele and Chris Bonuff. Hi.
Chris is in the back there.
I see, yeah. We'll wait for you for just a minute, Chris. Thanks. Okay, go ahead.
Morning, ma'am. I'm Sergeant, or good evening. My name's Sergeant Medlock. I work with the Washington County Sheriff's Office. I supervise the mental health response team. We embed a clinician with our deputies during our busy shifts. We respond to these mental health calls and deal with the folks that are in need of our services. Part of the biggest problem, I think, is there's been a traditional mistrust between the mental health community and law enforcement. That's just the way it's been in our state for a while. Due to recent events, we've tried our best to reach out to the mental health community, and they've reached back to us, and we're doing everything we can. What I'm asking for here a little bit is to make this process a little easier to implement for our mental health professionals through funding, a little bit more training. I really don't want to have to look a family member in the face again where we've had to use force or we've had to take action we didn't want to because we didn't have the time, we didn't have the knowledge that we could have had simply if we had to run them through LEDs. And my deputies don't want to have to use force if they don't have to. We can slow things down with a little bit more knowledge. And this LEDs entries can really help us out a lot, just a little bit. So anything you guys can do to help us implement that, I would really appreciate it.
Thank you for coming to testify.
My name is Kristen Burke. I am a program supervisor of adult mental health for Washington County. The main thing that I wanted to present is we've been in Washington County, one of the counties that has not been very efficient at utilizing LEDs. I did meet with our providers who serve our folks with severe and persistent mental illness and presented LEDs and really encouraged the utilization. I did receive some resistance, but a lot of the resistance was in terms of competing demands. There are so many things that are going on right now with system change initiatives, documentation standards, workload issues, staff turnover, that they really found it challenging to take on yet another task, another thing. Even though they may recognize that there's good utility in it, at the same time, it was just a matter of, wow, we already have so much on our plate, and this is another, what they said, unfunded recommendation, and we really struggle with that. So resources behind the implementation of LEDs would have really made a big difference. Thank you.
Thank you, Kristen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Steele. I'm the Chief Deputy with the Washington County Sheriff's Office. Primarily, I'm just going to reemphasize what Sergeant Medlock and Kristen have stated. I can't speak for all of law enforcement. We're fortunate in Washington County to have some resources that not everybody has. We're unique in a lot of ways. Our office, you know, directly has contact with well over 200,000 people a year. Unfortunately, a number of those suffer from mental health issues, medical issues, and we're looking for really any resource we have that will assist us in potentially violent confrontations and in ways that we can make those situations be solved in a manner where nobody gets hurt, they're handled efficiently, effectively, and we get people the resources they need primarily. So really, we're again just looking for any kind of support that you can provide to our mental health partners to help us get that information to the first line responders that need it at the most critical time in the person's time of need.
Any quick questions from anyone on this panel? Thank you so much. Thank you for making the effort to put this into use. Thank you. Chris Bonoff.
Both.
Thank you for coming, Chris.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I'm Chris Bonoff. I'm the executive director for the Oregon State Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and I'll be very, very brief. Our experience with this issue is that nothing has really risen to our level as complaints, and that's how we sometimes register whether or not something's very successful, and particularly with an issue like this. There is sensitivity between mental health community, those of us who live with mental illness, and law enforcement by and large, because we haven't been served very well by law enforcement. Of course, we've asked law enforcement to do a job in serving us that they're not weren't intended to do in the first place. So our interactions, we're very wary of something like this. We're very wary of the privacy issue. We're very wary of whether somebody responds, even using this information, if the person responding is equipped with CIT, because we also do believe that regardless of what information is in there, if an officer is not trained properly in a situation, the interaction has increased odds of going badly. But by and large, we are in favor of the sharing of information for those people who voluntarily would like to put their information in there. The other concern that we have and that we'll continue to watch is the coercion piece. I mean, that was a huge concern, is what is actual consent, particularly how is something like this presented, how is it wrapped into treatment planning, how is it that is presented to an individual or to a family in the case where a family member is bears responsibility for making decisions for a loved one. With all that said, conceptually, it's very encouraging that it is being utilized. It is encouraging that it's being utilized slowly, because I think you do have to be careful with things like this. But in conclusion, I would say, by and large, it conceptually will be a good thing once communities begin implementing it. So, thank you.
Want to see if we have any questions? Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Real quick, and this is not what we're talking about today, but I recently read that one of the states is looking at some way of getting the mental health history or flagging people for part of gun control. Have you looked into that, or has that been discussed at all in your...
That's a loaded question, to use a pun. Yes, I think we have to be very careful once we start that conversation for several reasons. One is there's a fallacy between gun violence and mental illness. So while we've had some very large public events that may or may not be related to mental illness, most gun violence is unrelated to mental illness whatsoever. So it's a potential answer that would not solve a problem. I think the second piece is whether your political leanings on gun ownership are, the Supreme Court has pretty well clearly said that gun ownership is a personal liberty. And in an association like mine, we're cautious about limiting personal liberties just because someone has a mental illness. And then who makes that determination? It probably doesn't answer your question totally, but it is a difficult issue to address.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Chris, and thanks for the work you do. So, Representative, I think the result of this is pretty disappointing for those of us who had worked on this issue, and it sounds like what we need is more resources. We need more crisis intervention training. We need more reassurance that people's privacy will be protected. So it seems like we still have some more work to do.
Well, I appreciated what Silas had said, Madam Chair, and as well as some of the others. But, obviously something's happening with Yamhill County for connection to having that, and see what we can do to kind of mirror that a little bit.
Yeah, good. Well, thank you for staying for the couple hours and coming to testify today. With that, I'm going to close the LEDS hearing. But, colleagues, I've talked with some of you about the possibility of us not, we'll, of course, not be meeting next Friday. So I want you to be thinking about the possibility of staying Mondays and Wednesdays until 5:30, and perhaps we can eliminate future Friday meetings. But I would ask you to keep Friday at 3 o'clock free in case we need to be doing a work session. So we'll be working with the vice chairs to see what we can do to make longer meetings on Mondays and Wednesdays, so maybe we won't have to meet on Fridays. Any question about that? Any question? Everybody's okay with that? All right. Yes.
Are you wanting to know our availability, or can we talk about that later?
We can talk about it later.
Okay.
Yeah. But if you've got a problem, let us know.
I have.
Because we'll know not to plan hearings. Okay, with that, we'll close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Thank you very much.
Take good, proud of you.